Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I am Donald Feltham, and we have, do you like to be called actor slash author, author slash actor? What do you like to be called? It's Ron Fasler, by the way. Welcome, Ron.
I like to refer to myself as a writer and a recovering actor.
Recovering actor. That's a very good way to put it. Ron has a brand new book out called The Show Goes On, Broadway Hirings, Firings, and Replacements. And it is all about basically what the title talks about. It's filled with wonderful stories about the world of Broadway, both musicals and plays, which I really like the fact that you covered a lot of plays as well, and the stories behind how people have been cast and replaced and understudies and standbys and people who go on and become stars because they stepped into the spotlight for one fortuitous night because the star was out and somebody happened to be in the audience and saw them. Lots of great tales, many that I knew, but many that I did not know, which was fun. And you interviewed a lot of people for the book.
Yes.
Which was great.
100 people.
Yeah. So, but first, let's give the listeners a little bit of background about you so they get to know you first. Talk about where you grew up, how you got into the biz and your career.
Well, I am a Long Island boy. I grew up in Great Neck. And for those who know geography, it's a 25-minute train ride right into Times Square. And I started taking advantage of that before I turned 12 years old. So New York City, Manhattan, the Broadway Theater District was my playground. And I went to the theater on my own practically for, I'm going to say, four straight years between the ages of 12 and 16. I was in Manhattan every weekend seeing a play. I had a paper route, and that gave me the money, which was about $10, $11 a week. And that afforded me my train ticket, my subway token, my lunch, my copy of Variety, 75 cents, and a theater ticket. The average ticket price during those years was about $3 to sit in the last row. I saw the original production of Company for $2. I mean, it boggles the mind, really, because the last row of a Broadway show now, if you're paying full price, can run as high as about $150, which seems insane. But, you know, we're this is it. Whatever the market bears is what they're going to charge. And it's sad because if I was a young boy today, how would I satisfy this hunger? How would I have fulfilled this dream of seeing all the theater I could see? I mean, imagine by the time I'm 16 years old, I've seen 200 Broadway shows, and I wanted to be an actor. So the education I received was phenomenal. I also came home after every single play and wrote my reviews. And that was the basis. Yes, that was the basis for the first book I wrote, which came out about 7 years ago, called Up in the Cheap Seats. Which is a very good title, a historical memoir of Broadway. I was there. So it's kind of this kid's take filtered through the lens of someone who's been in the profession for 50 years. I'm 67 years old. So I've been going to the theater steadily for 55 years. And it covers a great deal of territory. And I consider myself incredibly blessed that I got to see some of the truly greats before they shuffled off, like Mary Martin and Robert Preston and Ethel Merman and people of that ilk. I consider myself so fortunate because sometimes I live in that bubble of, oh gosh, if I only could have been alive during the 40s and the 50s when theater was even cheaper, right?
Right. but got the tail end of the golden age.
I did.
Into the transition of the 70s and on.
Exactly right. I was there for all the original Sondheim musicals that broke all the new ground and the British invasion and everything else. So I've been an actor. I was happily employed for most of my career. I was that small percentage of actor that actually made a living at it. I didn't have to hold down another job. I worked primarily in Los Angeles. I worked film and television a lot. I went out there, as most New York actors do, to test the pilot season. This was how it used to be done. And if you got a show, then that would be great. My goal was actually to get a television series that would then allow me to go to Broadway because, you know, they like name actors on Broadway. That was my path. I tried it for 6 years here, trying to get in my foot in the door. I got understudy jobs on Broadway and off Broadway, but I never made it onto the New York stage except in one play. And I really thought, wow, I really have to, you know, get this name for myself. And then Broadway will welcome me back with open arms. Well, instead, I ended up staying in California, setting down roots, raising two children. And so not to say I was stuck there, but I lived there for 30 years. Uh-huh. And then I moved back to New York 10 years ago after my divorce. And when I came back, I wanted to kind of reinvent myself. So instead of being an actor, I turned to writing. I'd always been writing. You know, during the time in Los Angeles, I wrote for television. I wrote an episode of Murphy Brown that aired. I wrote a television movie for Lifetime. I sold things that, you know, got me money, but didn't necessarily get made. That's a writer's plank, especially when you live out there. And when I came back, I really did want to write my Up in the Cheap Seats books, which got published about 2 years later. And then, as a result of Cheap Seats, I became a theater critic. And I've been an online theater critic now for a website called Theater Pizzazz, which I recommend listeners go take a look at. And I now go to see all Broadway, off-Broadway. I even review cabaret shows. I'm going to an opera tonight. So as the friends who've known me for a long, long time say, Ron, nobody in the world deserves free theater tickets more than you do.
So you sit through everything.
And I go to see everything, Donald, with the same youthful enthusiasm. That's the thing that people are kind of really amazed at. They'll say, aren't you jaded? Aren't you bored? I'm like, nope.
No.
Every time I sit down in the theater, I'm just, please, I want a transcendent experience. I don't sit there with my arms across my chest, prove it, show me. Right. No, I'm like, gosh, please. I pray for an experience that I'm going to go home and write about and try and get everybody to go see. There's nothing better than that. So that brings me to writing The Show Goes On, which came out of a column that I wrote on Broadway replacements. I have a blog called Theater Yesterday and Today, and I've written over 600 columns over these last 10 years. And I write about everything to do with the theater from the past to the present. And I started writing this column about Broadway replacements and realized, wow, it's more than one column. So I wrote three of them. And after the third one, people started saying, Ron, this is a book. Uh-huh. And it's never been written. A book about Broadway replacements. To have it all in the pages of one book, wherever you can just go and find out, well, who took over all those years Hello, Dolly ran for 7 years? And how many people, you know, went into a long-running show like Rent? How did that work? And how did the actors figure out a way in? I mean, imagine that you're Carol Channing and you've starred in Hello, Dolly, and you've been doing it for 2 years on Broadway, and then it's time to find the next person to take over. You know, how do the producers figure that out? How does the director come back and work with the actor or not? Sometimes they're put in just by a stage manager. How does that actor then figure out a way to make the part their own? I was fascinated by that. So what I bring to this book is not only my sort of theater historian knowledge, but I also bring my actor's perspective. You know, how does that work? And since I interviewed almost 100 actors, that is part of the conversation. And I speak the language. Uh-huh. So people reading the book who are actors will really sort of delve into that part of it. And lay people who just are so fascinated by the process, I think, so far from the feedback I've been getting, are also fascinated by it. So I've told numerous stories. The book's 400 pages. So we can absolutely go over a few of them, and I can tell your listeners a few of the highlights.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit. So growing up, you're going to all the shows. You're taking you're heading into New York to use your paper route money to see the shows.
Yeah, I barely came up to the box office, you know, and one ticket, please. I need a single.
But then what was the move into acting? Because did you grow up in a family that had any arts background? Was there none in the family? So what was college like? Did you study theater in college?
Yes, I went to a conservatory.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. I
And was your family like supportive of this concept?
My family was completely supportive. My dad was an accountant. My mother was a housewife. I had five brothers and sisters. There was nobody in my family tree that had any interest in the arts or theater. Now, my parents really liked going to movies and television and theater, and that was great. Uh-huh. Although, again, your listeners will probably laugh. My parents never took me to the theater. Wow. I took them. I took them as a teenager. Hey, Mom, Dad, you really should see this show. And I buy two extra tickets for them on my visit in. I grew up with six. There were six kids in the family. You know, they certainly said, gee, Ronnie really loves theater. We really should take him to something. But then I think their psychology was, well, then all the kids are going to want to sew something. Right. We can't afford it. Right. So I could afford it. I had the money. My parents never gave me a dime in allowance or anything like that. I did this myself. So your question, why? Where'd the interest come from? Well, at 5 years old, I went to see the movie of The Music Man. That came out in 1962. I was uh-huh. 5 years old, uh-huh. and I went to see it at the Radio City Music Hall, uh-huh. which used to only show movies. Uh-huh. And I sat in that 6,000-seat theater, and I was thunderstruck. I mean, I came home, and I wanted to be Robert Preston. And I just started singing all those songs from the show to the album. I went through the album. I mean, I had to get another one by the time I was about 10. And I just thought Robert Preston was the be-all and end-all, and I started looking for his name in the newspaper. When the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday Times, which was a ritual for anybody who loved theater, it would tell you the announcement of all the new shows. You'd read the ads. Uh-huh. I was always looking for an article on Robert Preston. And that's how it all started. So I had an aunt who I adored, and she knew about my love of Robert Preston. So she took me to see him and Mary Martin in I Do, uh-huh. I Do in 1968. I was 11 years old, and that started it. From that moment on, I was like, I want to see as many plays or musicals as I possibly can. And I made it happen.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. There we go. I wanted to get back to where the seed
the little
planted.
Boy.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. The Up in the Cheap Seats book really is this combination, as I mentioned earlier, about the world through my eyes as a little boy going to all these shows, but also as an adult looking back. And the book is filled with stories from people about the shows I saw, because I talked to so many people still involved. I mean, I talked to Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim and Mike Nichols all before they died. I mean, I was really, really lucky that I caught them. And those stories just are wonderful to read. But a very early reader of the book said to me, Ron, stories are great. Your theater history is great. But more you. You have no idea how invested we are in that little boy. If right. I go 10 pages and I've lost that little boy, bring him back, bring him uh-huh, back. Uh-huh. And it was the best piece of advice I got. Uh-huh. And I took it to heart. And that's what people respond to in the book. They
right.
really love the adventures of this little boy doing things that you can't quite imagine. And in fact, people used to say to my mother, you let him go into Manhattan in 1970? I mean, Times Square was...
Yes.
Dangerous. I mean,
yes.
I never walked down 42nd Street. You could not walk down 42nd Street.
Right.
The pimps and the muggers and the drug addicts and the winos. It was really tough. So I just steered clear, and I managed to get the job done. I was only mugged once.
Oh,
I didn't
God.
Get hurt. It's all right. I was 14. They took my money. They took my cheap Timex watch. And I just went back to the theater the next week. Nothing could keep me down. And yes, I did go to school. I went to Purchase, which is a wonderful acting conservatory. And I was going to be an actor from that day I saw Robert Preston. And thankfully, luckily, I was able to have some degree of success.
Okay. And where did you live in Los Angeles? I have to ask because I was born and raised here. So
wonderful.
I am a LA native. So
I kept moving west. I was Beverly Hills adjacent.
Okay, yes, we know what that means.
And at Carthay Circle, to be
yes,
very specific,
okay, yes.
In one of those great old duplexes on mm-hmm. Crescent Heights. Uh-huh. Then I moved to Santa Monica, had a lovely little house there. And then the final place I lived in, I had moved to Brentwood. I was north of Sunset.
Wow.
Okay. I had a house with a swimming pool. Yeah.
Nice.
And now I live in a small apartment, and that's fine with me.
That
life. No, I almost always imagined I would come back to New York and live out my final years. I don't sound like I'm aging, but it's a great place to be retired. New York City is a cultural mecca. There's
well,
so
it's
much
a different,
to do.
It is. It's
you
hard
walk
to
everywhere.
It's so different. It's so hard to explain to you. Yeah. Then I like the fact that you have had both experiences, because New York life is very different than LA life, and people don't always understand that. Having been born and raised here in Los Angeles, people don't understand that it's a very isolating life, because you live in a much more spread out community.
And you spend
all your time in your car alone.
Yeah.
So you don't have the constant body contact that you have on the streets and in subways of New York. So you don't
There's
have people
an adventure
in your face
every day. I moved back to New York after the divorce, mainly because I wanted to meet people. I was going to be a single man. And if you are living in Los Angeles, it's a lot harder.
It is.
It just is. You're in your car. In New York City, I meet people walking my dog. I mean, I meet people online. It's just, you're constantly out and about. And it's been reinvigorating. I truly, really adore it. Now, I'm going to say I have still deep ties to Los Angeles, and I raised two kids there, to the community, to people. The fires, the devastation of the fires has affected me very emotionally. And I have very, very good friends who lost everything. And I weep for it. I'm going to go back there in July for a long visit. But I find that even though we're all live, you know, stacked on top of one another in New York City, it's a very exciting place to be. If you can deal with it, you can deal with the noise and all the various things there are to deal with, but there's going to be headaches wherever you live. And,
that's true.
I find it, and I've got the theater and, it keeps me young. Let me tell you, it keeps me young.
Right. So let's move on to the book. And I wanted to kind of touch on some of the stories. And I thought we would start with where the book starts. And you started with Funny Girl, because we all current theater goers know of the most recent revival. And they know about the interesting casting choices and replacement choices and everything that went down. What I like about the story is that the history of Funny Girl, the original Broadway production, covers the story of a replacement really well, because a lot of people do not realize or even know that when Barbara Streisand left the show to go open the show in London, she was replaced on Broadway.
Yes.
And she was very successfully replaced on Broadway. Because one of the stories you always hear is that Funny Girl is, you can never revive Funny Girl because it will never run without Barbara Streisand. And they don't realize that she was replaced on Broadway, and the woman who replaced her on Broadway ran the show for a very long time after Barbara Streisand left. Very successful.
Almost as long as Barbara played.
Right. Yeah. And then you have the revival that we recently had a couple of seasons ago, which not only covers an original casting story, but a replacement story, but also an understudy story.
Yep.
And it also is nice because I think that coming out of the pandemic the way we did, I think Broadway audiences and theater goers never really understood or had a full appreciation of the value and the work and the importance of understudies and standbys.
Absolutely.
And as we were coming out of the pandemic, I think they got a better understanding of that. Because you got to see, I remember, even though I was here in LA, I followed theater very closely, especially New York theater, and you could see the shows opening and struggling to stay open with COVID still hanging around and struggling to get enough people on stage to get the show open every night because people were still coming down with COVID, and they were casts were made up of standbys and understudies and last minute cancellations if they couldn't get full cast together. And I think audiences were starting to understand the work that understudies and standbys and swings all do to keep a show running. And some of the biggest stars on Broadway were really honoring these people and putting them forward to say, these people worked their asses off.
Yeah. Very much so.
To do this job, and they are what's helping keeping Broadway open during the tough, tough times at the beginning of the time after the pandemic. So talk about a little bit about that, and then let's talk about Funny Girl.
Sure. I mean, the timing of the book was terrific because, yes, people were finally becoming aware that the understudies are, as Hugh Jackman dubbed them, the bedrock of Broadway.
Right.
And he called them that because during the previews of Music Man that he was doing in 2022, I think, he got to the theater one day and found out that Sutton Foster was going to be out. Uh-huh. And the understudy had never had a single rehearsal.
Right.
And they had maybe an hour or two to sort of show her around the stage, squeeze her into a costume. And she did the show flawlessly. And at the curtain call, Hugh Jackman just stopped everything and just did a shout out to Kathy Voitko, this unknown chorus woman who was covering not just Marrying the Librarian, she was covering a whole batch of other parts. And she hadn't had a single rehearsal. All she was doing was watching. All she was doing was observing. and, you know, going home and listening to the music and memorizing it. And she had no idea she would be called upon at 9 o'clock in the morning to go on for a 2 o'clock matinee. It's astonishing. And there were times the show, A Beautiful Noise, the, is that what
the Neil Diamond one?
Yeah. The Neil Diamond show. I think it had 21 people on it, and one day 14 people were out.
Uh-huh.
14 people. They had the assistant director with a script in his hand, shaking like a leaf going on uh-huh. stage, just so they didn't have to send everybody home.
Right.
So I knew that if I was going to write this book, I wanted to capture the reader right away. And I knew that my first chapter should be the funny girl story. First of all, it was still in the zeitgeist. It only happened 2 years ago.
Right.
And it's a fascinating story. And as you said, covers everything. Broadway hirings, firings, replacement. Hirings. Why did Beanie Feldstein get that part? Firings. Oh, my gosh. They let her go 3-4 months into the run and brought in Lea Michele, who everybody thought should have had the part in the first place, and suddenly turned the show into a sold-out smash hit. It's an extraordinary story. And I also figured that I could also tell, as you say, another part of the whole understudy equation, because that was the Julie Benko of it, who was the understudy for Beanie Feldstein and eventually Lea Michele, and how it all just whipped itself into this extraordinary kind of one-of-a-kind situation. You know that when Beanie Feldstein left, they had not yet recorded the what we call the original Broadway cast recording.
Right.
And they subsequently had Lea Michele do it, but they couldn't call it the original Broadway right. cast recording. They had to call it the new Broadway cast. But it's the only time that I have in mind, my mind, no one's corrected me yet, that the original star of a Broadway show was not asked to do the album. Was replaced. Uh-huh. Extraordinary. And I do feel quite bad for Beanie Feldstein. She was up against a tsunami of events that right. kept her from doing her best work. And yes, I do delve into the history of Funny Girl in the chapter, because it is important to understand how Barbra Streisand got the part and how she went on to do it. And this notion, as you said, that only Barbra Streisand can play the part. And that's why there's never been a revival of it. Because, you know, there had not been a Broadway revival since it opened in 1964 uh-huh. until they did this version. And I think the reason for that had to do with the movie.
Yes.
I think the movie just cemented in people's minds that it's Barbra Streisand's part. And, you know, woe to anybody that tries to do it. It's very similar to Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire, because he got to repeat that in the movie. And it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime role. Yul Brynner in The King and I. I mean, these are very tough for actors to compete with the memories up there, these, because they were also immortalized on screen and people over and over. But I did get to see the Funny Girl production with Beanie Feldstein, you know, during the height of its run, the week it opened on Broadway. And she really was not up to the part. And there was a fraction of the producers that did want to let her go in previews when it first started. And then there were people that wanted to keep her. And then a whole series of events that I go into, it all just added up to a really sad, sad experience for her and even for the company. And then bringing Lea Michele into the show to reinterpret and get the huzzas that they were hoping Beanie Feldstein would get, created an extraordinary situation. There really is nothing else quite like it to compare it to, because you eventually replace in a show, as I said before, somebody has to take over for Carol Channing if the show's going to run for as long as Hello Dolly did. But this was replacing somebody just weeks into the run.
Right.
It's a very rare occasion.
Right. And you have a really weird, odd situation, because there was no out-of-town tryout, so you didn't have a testing ground to test Beanie outside
That's
of New
correct.
York. And we're also living in a different time now where you've got social media. So you've That's got, right. you know, she's under the pressure of, even when she starts previews, she's not only got to deal with what's going on at the theater, but there's this, the online critics, not necessarily critics, but the online blog, people making comments online, are this onslaught of negative comments about Beanie online that flood the internet that they've got to deal with.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and then you've got, unfortunately, poor Julie Benko, who is kind of thrust into the middle of this, because I think it was like the weekend right after they opened.
Correct.
They let Beanie go back to the West Coast for a friend's wedding, which was like, and you cover that in the book. It's like, who in their right mind allowed that to happen? Exactly. I mean, it gives the impression that she's fleeing the city after bad reviews, and they're letting Julie go on, who is probably better suited for the role.
Yeah, she knocked it out of the park.
And she knocks it out of the park. And from then on, the word on the street, or at least online, is if you can see Julie, wait for Julie to go on, and now don't go see Beanie. And that's got to make things, tensions at the show even worse, because word on the street is wait for the understudy to go on and don't go see Beanie, Beanie leaves early, and then Julie has to take over in the interim before Leah can come in. So then Julie's got this whole run where she's got the show to herself, basically.
Yeah. It's amazing that from this disaster, they had a show that ran over a year and made money, back its $20 million investment. That's extraordinary.
Shocking.
But a very sad turn of events and bad producing, let's face it. I mean, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, you pointed out that original production was able to have somebody take over for
talk about
her name. Her name was Mimi Hines. She only just passed within the past 2 or 3 months. I tried to get her to speak to me for the book, but she was in ill health and couldn't. She lived till past 90, and she was a wonderful, very quirky, funny actress, comedian, and she was quite right for the part.
Yeah.
And she there's some footage of her. You can go to YouTube performing on the Ed Sullivan Show, singing the Private Schwartz from Rockaway Number and also Who Are You Now. She had the comedy. She had the pathos. She was a great singer. She had a terrific success with it. Other people, less so over the years. You know, there was a stock version in the 60s with Barbara Cook as Funny Girl. Not anybody's real idea of a Jewish funny girl. I mean, God love Barbara Cook, but, you know, miscast. Right. A lot of miscasting. Pia Zadora played it famously.
I know friends that were in that production. I know friends that were in that production because it was at Long Beach Civic Light Opera.
That's correct.
In Southern California. And I had friends, and the nickname for the show was Girl, because there was nothing funny about it.
Exactly. Girl. I love all those.
Yes, I remember that very well because I had friends in that show.
This is a real tangent, but I go into it in my book, but nicknames for shows just always, my two favorites are The Red Shoes, which was Julie Stein's last musical. So they called it Julie's Last Jam, which is brilliant. And my other favorite is the show, that was called The Prince of Central Park.
I saw The Prince of Central Park.
Okay. And the original star was Gloria DeHaven, not so famous MGM star of the 50s. And when she left the show, they called it Ain't Miss DeHaven. Now that's brilliant.
That is brilliant.
I have to just give you the credit.
Absolutely brilliant. And I saw that with Joanne Worley. I saw that show.
Yeah.
My God. Because it was in the days when I would go to New York multiple times a year, and I was determined to see every new musical
imagine if you're coming to New York on a very quick trip and trying to squeeze in as many shows as you can that The Prince of Central Park was ever at the top of your list.
It wasn't at the top of my list.
Series of circumstances that got you there.
No, it was, you know, I was determined to see every new musical that was playing while I was there, and it was playing, and God knows it was at the TKTS booth. So it was very cheap. And I think I saw like a Wednesday matinee. Me and, you know, about 25 little old ladies were the only people in the audience, probably. And I saw it. And I think that was the show that had, there were so many references to like Bloomingdale's or something. There were so many references to some department store that people were like,
correct.
Are they subsidizing this show?
You're absolutely correct. It was produced by a parking garage magnate.
Yes.
And this other woman who helped produce it was called the First Lady of the Florida Theater Community.
Yeah.
And she also decided to be the understudy. So when in between Gloria DeHaven and Joanne Worley, this woman, Jan McCart, went on. And it's the only time that I know that the producer took over the lead in a Broadway musical.
It
is on the wall of Joe Allen's fan flop.
It was a mess. It was a complete mess. Yeah. Anyway, but the Funny Girl story is a perfect way to kick off the book because, like
thank you.
Said,
yeah, I also wanted to
it covers
make it
everything.
Current. Yeah, yes. Because if I started with a story about Ethel Merman, I think people would be like, "Oh, I can't." you know, young people today don't really, it's hard for them to connect, right? They don't really know who the great Merm was anymore. But boy, they know who Beanie Feldstein and Lea Michele are. And I thought, if I can just hook the reader that way, then I'm home free. And then I can tell stories about when Vivian Vance replaced Ethel Merman in a musical. I love the research process. I really love, especially having eureka moments when I find that thing I'm looking for, or I find something I wasn't looking for. And wow, I'm like, oh, this is incredible. Spent lots and lots of times here in New York City at the Lincoln Center Library for the Performing Arts, where they've just got piles and piles of stuff. You can literally, if you want to find out how Greer Garson did when she replaced Rosalind Russell in Auntie Mame, going way, way back, I could open up a folder and these yellowed press clippings would just fall, almost disintegrating in my hands. Right. And I would read the press releases, and I would read, you know, in the old days when there were 8 newspapers in New York, you know, they had these gossip columns who were all vying for pieces of information. So you found these incredible little tidbits and things, and it's just too much fun. I could just do it forever. And Winnie Holtzman, who wrote Wicked and is a dear friend, she has the great quote I love repeating, which is, she said to me once, "I love research because it isn't writing." And, you know, most writers are afraid to just sit there and start to put it down on paper.
Any diversion is a good thing. Yes.
I love research. It's not writing.
Listen, kid. I got 36 expressions, sweet as pie to tough as leather, and that's 6 expressions more than all of them Barrymores put together. Instead of just kicking me, why don't they give me a lift? It must be a plot, 'cause they're scared that I've got such a gift. Well, I'm miffed, 'cause I'm the greatest star. I am by far, but no one knows it. Wait, they're gonna hear a voice, a silver flute. They'll cheer each tooth. Terrific, kid, terrific. When I expose it, now can't you see, to look at me, that I'm a natural Camille. As Camille, I just feel I have so much to offer. Hey, kid, I know I'd be divine because I'm a natural coffer. Some ain't got it, not a lump. I'm a great big clump of talent. Laugh, they'll bend in half. Did you hear the one about the nearsighted Indian? 1,000 jokes, stick around for 'em, folks. 1,000 faces. I reiterate, when you're gifted, then you're gifted. These are facts. I got no axe to grind. Hey, what are they, blind? In all the world so far, I'm the greatest star. Who is the pip with pizzazz? Who is all ginger and jazz? Who is as glamorous as? Who's an American Beauty rose with an American Beauty nose and 10 American Beauty toes? High on the target and wham! One shot, one gunshot, and bam! Hey, Mr. Ziegfeld, here I am. I'm the greatest star. I am by far, but no one knows it. That's why I was born. I blow my horn till someone blows it. I light up like a light, right up like a light. I'll flicker then flare.
And one of the things I also like about the book is that some of the stories, even though they're focused on is the actual process of casting and replacing people, but it's also about putting a show together and getting shows on their feet and the whole process of how an out-of-town tryout can be such a mess. And you really delve into some of that because sometimes it does involve cast issues.
Yeah.
And I think the story behind Seesaw is probably one of the most interesting because it has so many different ramifications, historically speaking.
Yes.
Because the show was in so much trouble in Detroit during the out-of-town tryout, that when things started to change, when they started bringing in a new director and he brought in Tommy Toon and the cast starts changing and all these things are going on and people's feelings are getting hurt and relationships are being really damaged, as we know, as you are going to talk about, it's the putting up of Seesaw becomes a really interesting look at the show, the putting up a show process, putting together a Broadway show and fixing a Broadway show. They don't turn it into a classic, but they make it good enough to get to Broadway and good enough to run a decent amount of time and win some Tonys and get it at least in good enough shape that it can get somewhere.
Yeah.
And they ultimately end up, you know, getting Tommy Toon's career flying out the door, you know, getting on its feet. But talk about Seesaw, because it's such a, the whole chapter on Seesaw is so interesting because there's so many pieces to it that a lot of sad stuff is going on at this thing.
Very much so. Well, I mean, that was obviously a show I knew I was going to get into.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, the co-star of Seesaw, the late Ken Howard, was a dear friend of mine. So I had so many Seesaw stories already from him. Uh-huh. And then I needed to do the Rashomon effect, get it from Michelle Lee's point of view and get it from Lainey Kazan's point of view and make sure of it. So for your listeners, Seesaw was a musical that was produced in 1973 and was based on a very, very successful Broadway play in the late 1950s called Two for the Seesaw, which was a two-person play. It starred Henry Fonda and Anne Bancroft. It actually was the thing that launched Anne Bancroft's career. She won the Tony Award. She won all the reviews, too, which did not make Henry Fonda very happy. But the show was a huge hit, and the idea to make it into a musical is not a really good one, to be honest with you, because you know, they had to make it bigger. There had to be a chorus. You're taking this little two-person musical. They could have made a little chamber musical out of it, maybe, but they decided to do a big, full-on, big Broadway splashy musical. And they were in terrible trouble in Detroit. The director wasn't up to the task. The score was written by Cy Coleman and Dorothy Fields, who had last collaborated on Sweet Charity. These were two major professionals. And the book was by Michael Stewart, who had written Carnival and Bye Bye Birdie and Hello Dolly. I mean, this was a class act all the way. But it was in deep, deep trouble. And it would have closed out of town had it not been for a desperate phone call that the producers put out to Michael Bennett. The first one went out to Jerome Robbins. He was always the first person.
Uh-huh.
And he turned practically everything down. Funny Girl, by the way, was one that Jerome Robbins saved. Uh-huh. That was a musical in trouble out of town originally. But Michael Bennett came in and he brought in, yes, Tommy Toon as an associate choreographer. He brought in Bayark Lee, uh-huh. who later he would cast in Chorus Line, and they were good friends. He brought in Bobby Walsh, who also became a great choreographer. And he kept on Grover Dale, who was the original choreographer. There were six choreographers on this show. And he turned it into this enormous dance musical. Tommy was teaching this wonderful actor the big, big second act show-stopping number. And Michael Bennett came to the rehearsal and went, Tommy, you're going to do this number. Fired that actor. Fired 13 people. Uh-huh. He fired the lead, Lainey Kazan. Lainey Kazan was forced to do the play every night while Michelle Lee rehearsed a different version of the play all day long. And Lainey Kazan said at one point, I actually thought they were just going to see me in a different light in some way and say, you know, Lainey really is pretty good. We should just send Michelle home. Lainey can take this to Broadway for us. But of course, that's not what happened. Poor Ken Howard.
And
rehearsing a different day during an entirely different show in the day and performing the old one at night.
Right.
I don't know how he kept his head on his shoulders.
And just to interrupt for 1 second, and the other issue with Lainey Kazan was they didn't think she physically, they thought she was physically too heavy.
Correct.
And they wanted her to lose weight. And the fact that they brought in Michelle Lee, and initially, my understanding is they didn't tell her initially they were bringing Michelle Lee in. And she and Michelle Lee were best friends.
They were best
friends. In New York. They lived in the same building in New York. And they were best friends. And so during the day, her best friend is rehearsing to replace her.
They kept them in separate hotels.
And they kept them in separate hotels.
The whole thing was deceptive.
It was horrible.
Really extraordinary. Yeah. Michael Bennett, you know, made few friends. But yeah. he brought the show to New York. In a shape, he said that he did the work that would usually take him 3 months in 3 weeks. And it's true.
Right.
They completely ripped the show inside out. And by the time it came to town, they were previewing in New York. Those were literally the final rehearsals. They had never really done it in Detroit. Uh-huh. So they were running out of money. And I mean, the whole thing was just a Hail Mary pass. And it actually got some good reviews. But it came in at the end of the Tony season. So it missed the Tony deadline. It couldn't capitalize on Tony nominations until the following season when it had already closed. Right. And it ended up winning two of them. But I mean, it really is a very, very complex story that I tried to tell from as many different points of view as I could. And I think it is one of the highlights of the book because it's a lesson in how to turn a show around, but it's also, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs.
And that's the part that makes it so wrenching to read is that you realize that Bennett is doing what he needs to do to save the show. And a lot of people get hurt. And, you know, the Michelle Lee-Lainey Kazan friendship basically gets destroyed because Lainey Kazan just can't forgive Michelle Lee for taking the part.
And but then Michelle
they make
told
up
me
they
this.
They do make up.
Michelle did tell me this incredible story of their and now they're friends again.
But, and it was like, but it was so like years later. It was like years later. Yeah. Years later. That they finally made up. But it's a dirty business sometimes. It just is.
Yes. And then poor Lainey, she actually rebounded quickly, got cast in another Broadway play, and got fired from that play.
I know.
I mean, it really did a number on her. In the theater. It really did. She's a survivor, though. She's still out there.
And, yeah.
She did eventually come back to Broadway in my favorite year.
Yes.
Repeating that role she did in the movie.
Yes.
And then she had that great success with My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yep.
So that's the showbiz of it all. You know, if you stick around long enough, you know, you may have a comeback or two.
Right. And Michelle Lee certainly had plenty of happy career. And, you know, Ken Howard certainly survived it. I mean, the people and of course, like, you know, Tommy Tune won the Tony Award for featured actor in a musical. And that was the beginning of his career, basically.
Absolutely.
Launched his career. So
that's right.
You know, Seesaw.
He'd been doing musical variety programs in Los Angeles. He had the small role in
Hello Dolly.
And this was it for him.
They're not loved like I'm being loved. In this world, there's no girl alive. Got the goosebumps that I've got today. Feel so rich today. I'd give everything but him away. This town would slip. But they just can't make the contact. He's under exclusive contract to me. For everybody else, pity everybody else. I could sit down and cry for everybody else but me. Poor. Everybody else. physically tied, we're spiritually tied. Like he says, we're interdependers, like pants and suspenders, we match. It's funny how we match. And what's more, we hit it off from scratch. I love my friends, but just in case they are tempted, remember this guy's preempted by me for everybody else. Lonely everybody else. Got a lump in my throat for Paul.
I tell you, the bravery of these actors too, that they will do anything it takes. I mean, these actors like Michelle Lee that jump on an airplane and go to this out of town tryout, and they look at the show and they go, would you like to step in and take over? I mean, you got to be really sure of yourself, and because, you know, if it fails, they can blame you. Just even taking over for somebody who has scored a tremendous, tremendous success. Like when Hugh Jackman did The Boy from Oz on Broadway, he turned a mediocre musical into a smash hit. You could not get a ticket to that show. But he did it for a year. And when it was over, there was no sense bringing in somebody else.
That
was his part. That was, you know, now there are rumors, by the way, that it might get revived with Jonathan Bailey, because now we have
another
young, marvelous musical theater guy who could play that part. But at the time, there was nobody else who could replace in Boy from Oz. And they closed it. And they did the same thing with his Music Man revival a few years ago. There was a little bit of talk, maybe somebody could replace him, but instead they did the safe thing. The show was successful. The investors got their money back and they closed it. They put 100 people out of work. They could have tried to run it with Justin Timberlake or somebody else, but they decided to close it. And that is what happens a good deal of the time now. The days of a show like a star vehicle, like Music Man, like Dolly running. Well, let's take the Bette Midler Dolly, for example. They decided, yes, let's bring Bernadette Peters. Let's see if that could have the same impact Bette Midler had. Because, you know, Bette Midler in that show was a sensation.
They were printing money.
But Bernadette, trooper that she is, didn't have any qualms about following Bette. She went, that's a great part. I'm 70 years old. This could be my last hurrah. And she went into the show and she did not sell the way Bette did. And she sold okay, you know, but they got cold feet. And the chance of once Bette's contract was up, bringing in somebody else, just they folded it. You know, that was not going to have the 7-year run the original Hello Dolly had with 7 amazing dollies. I just think those days could be over. Now, of course, we have shows that run for years and don't require name actors as replacements. You don't need them for Book of Mormon. You don't need them for Hamilton. You never needed a name actor in Lion King from day one.
Lion
King sells on its title. Now, Chicago, which has its own chapter in my book, is a true lesson in creative producing. What the Weislers have done to keep Chicago running for almost 30 years is Herculean. It's extraordinary.
And people, and I got to tell you, I mean, you know, and you know this because you've been in the New York theater community, but people used to make fun of the Weislers. I mean, people were, you know, the Weislers were not always considered the top of the Broadway producer ladder. And they were, people sometimes made fun of them for stunt casting or some of the shows that they did. But guess what? Chicago is the longest running American musical, period. It just is. And it soon may surpass Phantom at some point. And it's because they know how to produce. And they have been very smart with Chicago. And they know what I give them credit. They have known how to keep this show going.
I also took the time to tell a bit of their history to the readers.
Yeah.
of my book because, you know, they come out of children's theater.
Right.
They used to do shows in a station wagon. They had Robert De Niro helping them move scenery.
Yeah.
They came up the hard way.
Yeah. I give them credit.
And of course, the story of Chicago was that it was part of the Encores, sort of stage, semi-staged version of it. And they went to see it, were wowed by it, and thought it would work just like that on Broadway. Take the concert version and put it on Broadway. And they went to all of their usual backers and said, what do you think of the idea? Look at the reviews it got. We've got B.B. Newworth and Ann Reinking, Jimmy Naughton, they'll all come with it. What do you think? And every single one of their usual backers went, you're crazy.
Right.
Nobody's going to want to see that.
Right.
And so they went, all right, it won't cost that much. They did the thing you're never supposed to do. They put their own money into the show. And do we all know how that ended?
Yeah.
It's a $1 billion industry.
Right. And they, and I think, and you also comment about that they expected, I think that they expected that there were going to be other people clamoring to do it. And they were the only ones.
They called Candor and Ebb and said, you know, they'd already done a revival of Zorba with them. They
knew
them. They said, what do you think, guys? Can we get in on this? Is there any way we can be part of it? They went, part of what?
You're the only ones.
Call. You're the only call.
And the movie would never have happened. The movie version would never have happened if that revival had not happened.
That's correct. The movie version came after the revival.
Yep. Yeah. It never would happen.
Now, of course, because I was a teenage theater goer, I saw the original Chicago in 1975.
Yes. And I saw the Long Beach production that you talk about.
The one with B.B. Newworth
and Juliet Prowse, yes.
Yeah.
So I saw that. That was during the L.A. riots.
Wow.
When we were under curfew. So we could go to the theater, but we had to drive home during curfew. So you could drive home during curfew.
The night of the riots is when you
went to see. No. It was after the riots, but...
We were
still under curfew when I went to go see it. So I had to drive home because I was living in Westwood at the time. So I had to drive up during, once the show let it, because we had like a 10 p.m. curfew. So after the show, we were driving home during curfew.
Well, speaking of replacements, I understand Juliet Prowse was like the perfect.
She was fantastic.
And B.B. Newworth must have been incredible.
Well, B.B. Newworth was, she was playing Velma. Right. And that's why she wanted to do the Encores version because she had just done it at Long Beach. But it was nice to see because you were able to see the original, they were using the original set design. It was based off the original Broadway production.
It was not the concert version.
It wasn't the concert version. So you got to see a full stage version of Chicago with Juliet Prowse and B.B. Newworth. And I can't remember, Gary Sandy, I think. What's his face? And
Billy Flynn.
And I can't remember who Amos was. I can't remember who the rest of the cast was.
Yeah.
But it was.
Was that the first time you ever saw Chicago?
It was the first time I'd ever seen Chicago. I mean, I knew the score because I had the cast recording, but I didn't see the original on Broadway. So
I don't know if you or I will live long enough, but eventually there'll be a Broadway revival of Chicago with Tony Walton set. You know, they'll go back.
Oh, I would love
to see
that.
And they'll do a full production of Chicago.
Yeah, I would love to see it, a full production. Yeah. I want to turn to another really sad one that I thought you handled really, really well. And that is the story of Company with Dean Jones. Because I don't think a lot of people, I am surprised I come across so many people who don't know the Dean Jones story with Company.
Well, they have the album, so they know he's on the album.
Right. They know he's playing Bobby.
They know he only played it for less than a month on Broadway.
Yeah. And they're like, but he didn't get a Tony nomination.
Right.
And Larry Kurt replaced him, and Larry Kurt got a Tony nomination. And how does that work? And that's not supposed to happen. And it never has happened again. Right. And Dean's on the cast recording. So, you know, and Dean Jones was the guy who was in all those Disney comedies. And, you know, and they don't know the story. So tell us briefly kind of the story.
Sure.
I knew most of it, but it's very sad. And
as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, you know, I saw the original Company for $2 and I saw it the week it opened, and Dean Jones was in it, and he was marvelous. And then the next thing I knew, I read a little thing in the paper that Dean Jones was out of Company with hepatitis, and Larry Kurt, his understudy, would take over. And then Dean Jones never returned. And I didn't get the story for many years later. But what happened was, while they were in Boston and the show was not in trouble, but it was not a fait accompli. It was going to be a success. I mean, there were things that needed to be changed. And Dean Jones was going through a very painful divorce. And he found the show to be in many ways nihilistic, and it was hurting him. And he said to Hal Prince, "I can't go on. I it's tearing me apart." And Hal Prince was empathetic, and he said, "Listen, Dean, please see me to opening night on Broadway, and I will make sure, give me a performance, get this show open so I've got a hit on my hands, and I will replace you." And Dean Jones, true to his word, stayed with the show. He recorded the original cast album a week later, which we all have that wonderful documentary that shows him and shows how good he was in the part.
Yeah.
And then he left the show forever. Then you got to fast forward to 1993, when they decided to do a reunion concert in Long Beach. We're back in California again. And I was present that night at this one performance only night where the entire original cast, save for one actor who had since passed, replaced by his understudy, and Dean Jones, finally back again as Bobby, performed the entire show in concert. And I will tell you, it was one of the most memorable nights I ever went to the theater, to see Dean Jones reclaim this role, take it back literally, and show us what he was capable of as a musical theater actor, was really, really touching. And it is very sad that he only managed to come back to Broadway one more time in a very, very bad musical called Into the Light, a musical about the Shroud of Turin. I mean, when you think of Broadway subject matter, you just think Shroud of Turin. We really were robbed of a wonderful actor's abilities. And that's, again, another just strange thing about the theater. It's ephemeral. It comes, it goes. And if you're there and you capture that lightning in a bottle, if you're, you know, in that audience and see that performance, you kind of never forget it. I don't think anybody's ever topped Dean Jones and company. I've seen a lot of different companies.
Yeah, I have too. And I think, but I think it also points out what I like about it also is it also gives you some insight into what goes into acting for the stage and what goes into what actors have to put into their performances and how much it takes out of you to do 8 shows a week.
And some actors pay a price. They pay
and the emotional depth that you have to go to. It's different than doing a movie or doing television. It's just
very much
so different.
Eight a week is very, very hard. And a lot of people who say, "I want to try that. I want that to be a part of my valise, my arsenal," and they do it and they go, "Never again." You know, and then some people return to it late. I discuss how Paul Newman was a great theater actor, but once he became a big movie star, He really only came back once with his wife in a very short-lived play, Joan Woodward. And then he came back at the very, very end of his career to do Our Town on Broadway for a brief amount of time. But Robert Redford, who is a wonderful Broadway actor, has never come back. Brando never came back after Streetcar. In fact, Brando, he poo-pooed movie acting. He thought movie acting was just ridiculous. The only real acting was theater acting. But boy, once he got a hold of what movie acting was all about, he was like, "I'm not doing stage acting anymore," because he got very bored during Streetcar. He was not the kind of guy that likes to do a long run, and it's a shame. I mean, you know, he was supposed to be so electric on stage. I mean, when you talk about that time machine, what show would you like to go back and see? Can you imagine going back and seeing opening night of Streetcar Named Desire? People had never seen an actor do what he did in that show.
Right.
I mean, there are books that have been written about it. Again, another very difficult part to replace, but very few people know that his replacement on Broadway was Anthony Quinn.
I know. Yeah.
You know, a great, great actor. But, you know, there was no fear at that point. You know, then he hadn't become Marlon Brando yet.
Right, exactly.
You know, but then anybody else who's been trying to follow in his footsteps all these years, including people like Alec Baldwin. And we got Paul Mescal coming to Broadway, actually to Brooklyn, this season with his Streetcar. So it's nice to know some people.
Well, once it's committed to film, it becomes, you know, embedded in people's brains that is the performance.
That's
So and just to note, you know, Larry Kurt did step in. Larry Kurt from West Side Story did step in and replace Dean Jones. And in a really weird quirk, the Tony Admin Committee made the decision.
Well,
at the request of Hal Prince.
Yeah, that he was like, "Dean only did it for a month. Please, you got to consider. It's going to be weird if Dean Jones gets a nomination." And some of the voters didn't even get a chance to see him.
Right. So Larry Kurt was allowed to compete as best actor in a musical that season, even though he was a replacement.
But then Hal Prince, a few years later, was in the position where he had directed On the 20th Century, a big musical that Madeline Kahn was starring in, and he had to fire her a few weeks into the run.
Yeah.
And he replaced her with Judy Kaye, who since then became a star.
Yeah.
And he petitioned the Tony Committee. He said, look, it's really not fair. Madeline's out of the show. Judy's doing it. Judy should be nominated. And they were like, well, if you count the number of performances as of this date, Madeline's done more than Judy. And, you know, uh-huh. And subsequently, it's just there was no way, you know, Lea Michele could be nominated. I mean, it was just, it's just, it's not going to happen anymore. It's just, that's,
right,
that's not
right.
Bobby.
What do you get? Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
That's true, but there's more than that.
Is that all you think there is to it?
Got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't one good reason for being alone.
Come on, you're onto something, Bobby. You're onto something.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
You see what you look for, you know.
You're not a kid anymore, Robbie. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo.
Hey, buddy, don't be afraid that it won't be perfect. The only thing to be afraid of really is that it won't be.
Don't stop now. Keep going.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
And what does all that mean?
Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there? It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Add 'em up, Bobby, add 'em up.
Someone to crown you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through. Will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive.
Blow out the candles, Robert, and make a wish. Want something. Want something.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive. Being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with praise. Days, but alone is alone, not alive. Somebody crown me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive.
let's talk about the Weislers again, and talk about Annie Get Your Gun, because there was a big revival of Annie Get Your Gun. I will withhold my own personal comments about this revival because I was not a huge fan of this revival at all. That's the only comment I'm going to say. But it was the big Bernadette Peters revival of Annie Get Your Gun, which again, it's one of those situations where, you know, the Weislers are doing their star recasting of the show. You know, it opens with Bernadette, and Bernadette wins a Tony for Best Actress. And talk about the replacements, because they pulled out the stops and pulled in kind of the typical Weisler star stunt casting.
Right. The first person to go on was Susan Lucci, famous Erica Kane of All My Children.
Right.
And she did on a vacation stint, and I think she did quite well for them. And then they brought in Cheryl Ladd, another TV star. Funny, because she herself was a replacement for Farrah Fawcett, Charlie's Angels.
Right.
And then they finally got the person I think they really wanted all along.
And it was like a bombshell. It was like an absolute, because I remember when this happened. And
well, let's tell the audience who it is.
Yeah, it was Reba McEntire. And first off, I think people were a little dumbfounded because it was like Reba McEntire, like the country singer. And I remember after she opened, people could not stop talking about it. Everybody I knew in New York was like, you have to come see this. You have to come see this woman. She is amazing. They said, even if you did not like Bernadette Peters in the role and did not like the show with Bernadette Peters, it's an entirely different show. They said,
so I imagine you did not get the chance to see her.
No, I didn't.
So Bernadette and you didn't get Bernadette. To see Reba.
But they were like, it's a completely different show with Reba McEntire. They said, it's just unbelievable.
Well, the thing is, Reba McEntire is, she's a natural. She really, because if you go and watch her in South Pacific that they staged at Carnegie Hall for one night only and PBS broadcast, you will watch when she is speaking dialogue, she suddenly starts singing and you're fully unaware the orchestra has already crept in, and she moves from dialogue to music with a efficiency and a fluency that is very, very rare, that most actors don't know how to do. And she does it. It's natural. She doesn't have to learn that. It's just something she knows how to do. The character also, she comes from that neck of the woods. She's an Oklahoma gal. Her father roped steers and her grandfather. I mean, she's of that world. Bernadette Peters grew up in Queens.
Right.
I mean, she's a marvelous actress, but she's nowhere near the natural fit for Annie Oakley. Neither was Ethel Merman, for that matter, or Mary Martin. I mean, Reba McEntire was just perfect casting. They managed to squeeze her in between her very, very hectic performing schedule as a singer performer, and they only had her for the limited time they had her. She could have run in that show for a year or two.
Easily.
And she was a sensation. Barbara Cook went to see her 6 times. I saw Barbara Cook in a concert, and she wouldn't stop talking about Reba McEntire. She was saying to the audience, you've got to go see this performance. And you can see it in clips on YouTube. You will get a sense of just how right she was. And I spoke with Brent Barrett, the actor who was playing Frank opposite her, and he said it was jaw-dropping. He just had no idea what her process was. I mean, she just came to it completely open as an actor and a singer and just dove in with both feet. And it was just a clear success from the moment she started until the last night she performed. Just absolutely had the tiger by the tail.
And I think that was the key, is I think that she had all of her, she had the stage presence because of all of her years as a concert performer.
Right.
But she also had the because she had not been an actress, she had the naivete of an Annie Oakley.
Yeah.
In the sense that she was just this country girl at heart who had never been on an acting stage. And that's sort of who Annie Oakley is at the beginning of the show. She's this naive girl from the country who suddenly becomes a star. And I think that comes across with Reba. And I think she still is like that. I mean, even after all the success that she's had on television and everything, I think that she is that person. And I think that that is what comes across. That's why people, I mean, people still love her like crazy.
And amazing.
And I think, I mean, I think if she ever wanted to come back to Broadway, she could do so in an instant if they could find the right property for her.
Absolutely. But the problem is, you know, these actors, they get older, you know.
Right. Well, she couldn't, she couldn't do a young part, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I love when people start, you know, opining in chat rooms, you know, what Bette Midler should be doing MAME. I'm like, Bette Midler is 75 years old.
Exactly.
It's 8 a week in MAME. It's, come on, you got to be realistic, guys.
Right.
I mean, I still can't believe that there are actors who will continue in their careers into their 80s and even 90s. When Elaine May won the Tony Award for the Waverly Gallery, I think she was 89 years old and won for the leading role. I mean, actors, they blow my mind. I have such respect. And you know, I live here and I go to the theater. I was at the theater yesterday. I'm going tonight. It still is a mecca for talent. I mean, the level of expertise you see on a daily basis, if you go like I do, it's a knockout.
Oh, my mother was frightened by a shotgun, they say. That's why I'm such a wonderful shot. I'd be out in the cactus and I'd practice all day. And now tell me, what have I got? I'm quick on the trigger with targets not much bigger than a pinpoint. I'm number one, but my score with a feller is lower than a seller. Oh, you can't get a man with a gun. When I'm with a pistol, I sparkle like a crystal. Yes, I shine like the morning sun. But I lose all my luster when with a Bronco Buster. Oh, you can't get a man with a gun. The gals with umbrellas are always out with fellers in the rain or the blazing sun. But a man never trifles with gals who carry rifles. Oh, you can't get a man with a gun. With a gun, with a gun. No, you can't get a man with a gun. A Tom, Dick, when the preacher has made them one. But he can't build you houses with buckshot in his trousers. And you can't shoot a male in the tail like a quail. Oh, you can't get a man with a gun. For a pistol packing mamas.
I've picked my stories from the book that I wanted to cover. So I want you to pick your favorite story or one of your favorites. I'm sure there's a lot of favorites, but what
I do, I do. I thought about this, but I thought for your audience, I thought a story about a show they all know and a story they don't know is the story of The Wiz.
Uh-huh.
And The Wiz, when it came out in 1975, was a show that nobody expected to be a hit. It was a disaster on the road. It had so many problems. They had to fire the director. They had to fire the choreographer. The lead actor playing the Scarecrow, an actor named Stu Gillum, quit the show at the end of Act One. He cleaned out his dressing room and quit the show on the road in the middle of the show. And Hinton Battle, who would go on to become a three-time Tony Award-winning actor, was in his dressing room. He was in the chorus. He was 17 years old. And the stage manager walks in and says, "Hinton, can you go on as the Scarecrow?" They had no understudies. He went, "You're kidding." The guy said, "Do I look like I'm kidding?" So they instantly started stuffing him into the Scarecrow costume, putting on the makeup. And in the meantime, they're trying to tell him what he has to do in Act Two. And he's listening and going, "Guys, there's no way I cannot do this." And Stephanie Mills, who herself was all of 17, she said, "Listen, all you need to do is look at me and I'll tug your sleeve when it's time for you to talk and just say whatever you want. You're supposed to be brainless anyway." And in the meantime, Jeffrey Holder, the director, who I don't know, people remember Jeffrey Holder, yes, was a villain in a Bond movie. He did those
Seven Up commercials, right?
He was like a 6'6" black man, and he's in the dressing room. And his only advice to Hinton Battle as he's getting made up is, "More glitter, darling, more glitter." You know, it's just how Hinton Battle tells the story. But Hinton Battle goes on. He just frumpers his way through it. Charming 17-year-old kid. The next morning, his phone rings. It's the producer of The Wiz. He goes, "Hinton, how would you like to open as the Scarecrow on Broadway?" And it started his career. He didn't even intend to go to Broadway with it. His goal was to make enough money during the out-of-town tryout so that he could go back home to Washington, D.C. and attend the American School of Ballet. He didn't have any money. Uh-huh. And instead, he comes to Broadway and stars in The Wiz. And The Wiz runs for 3 years. I mean, you just can't write this stuff.
Yeah,
it's just extraordinary. And it's a number of factors that make it all happen. But boy, when it's all right and everybody, the pieces start to fit together. I mean, the chaos of that show, you could make that into a movie, you know, how The Wiz got to Broadway and how it became a success. Because then also it was the reviews were not great and it was frumpering at the box office. They made a commercial. Uh-huh. And it was only the third Broadway commercial there'd ever been. Pippin was the first. Then John Cullum standing out in a field singing Shenandoah was the second. And East on Down the Road, The Wiz was the third Broadway commercial. And once that commercial aired, that was it.
Yeah.
We're a hit.
Show you how to smile. He's on down, he's on down the road.
And they won the Tony, and things and things just kept going.
And I love the statement that Stephen Sondheim makes. It's his favorite musical, and he said the reason, and he saw it like three or four times on Broadway, and he said the reason is it's the one show that you walk in one way, and when you walk out, you feel a whole different way. That's how he described it. It just it made you feel good, and that was important to him. Funny coming from Sondheim, right? Who was not really interested in his own shows in providing happy, tidy endings. You know, if you look at Company and Follies and Passion.
And Sweeney Todd and, you know.
Exactly.
All those big uplifting family happy
musicals.
Right.
Exactly.
So what is, with the book is now out and.
Yes, out since November and it's doing well. It's available exclusively through my website. You can go to ronfassler.org.
There
it's
will be
a show goes on.
There'll be a link here on the website so people can go right to your site.
If you forget that, just Google me. It'll take you there.
Google you and Google the book's title, which is The Show Goes On, Broadway Hirings, Firings, and Replacements. And what is next for you? What's the next book going to be? I know it's, you know, you have a book coming every year, I assume, so.
No. Well, yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you. It was great to get the book done. It was 2.5 years of just solid, you know, working every day. And once it was off my plate, instead of that sigh of relief, it was, oh, now what do I work on?
Right.
I mean, I have my columns. I write my theater reviews. I'm a busy person. But I really want to be embroiled in a project. So I'll put this out to your listeners if they all want to contact you and tell them if it's a book they want to buy. It's very niche. It's a very specific thing. But I think the stories are going to be wonderful. There is a very small number of Broadway shows that had their preview periods on Broadway and then never made it to opening night.
Yeah.
These are shows that closed in previews.
Yeah.
So I have a title for the book. It's Previews of Disaster, Broadway's Roadkill. And these are all shows, for whatever various reasons, they got the audiences, they got the tickets, they had the pictures in front of the theater, but they had a show that the producers just finally pulled the plug on and said,
"And did they actually
let the critics come? We cannot let the critics come."
Okay. And are these ones that actually played preview performances?
Yes.
Okay.
These are all shows that closed during the preview period
in New York.
On Broadway.
So they don't
Broadway
count.
Theaters.
So they don't count if they had the marquees up, but they actually never came in.
These are shows that actually came in, right?
Okay.
There are some shows that have their marquees up, closed out of town.
Like the infamous Busker Alley that had the Leroy Neiman paint job on the St. James Theater.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, The Baker's Wife with Patti LuPone.
Right. Those don't count.
Marquee was up.
Those don't count.
No, it's got to be a show that people actually came to see, and then the producer said, no, people cannot come see this anymore. We are not opening.
I have a poster. I have a poster for one of those shows. It's one of my favorite post-theater
posters. Tell me which one it is.
Face Value. I have the poster for that. I love that poster. It's like one of my favorite posters.
And the last one there was something called Bobby Bolin.
Yeah, yes.
And it starred Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah.
And that one could just not make it to opening night.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I've even got one show that closed at its final rehearsal.
Oh my.
How about that?
Okay.
They had an invited dress.
Is that?
This show starred James Earl Jones. It had it was a real Broadway show. It was called Beloved Infidel.
Okay.
And it was a version of Julius Caesar, but it was Castro. It's Fidel Castro.
Oh, okay.
And and it had a wonderful cast, very fine director, everything. They did the final dress for her, the invited dress.
Invited dress,
really
that counts.
People.
That counts.
And,
that's a preview.
The producer said, go home.
It takes.
The set was built. They were ready to start the very next night in the theater, and they went home.
But, you know, I give a producer a lot of credit if they're willing to pull the plug on a show during previews. Sometimes
the most famous one really is Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yes, obviously,
that David Merrick, the most famous producer of his day, had a musical with a very large advance sale. He had to return $600,000.
Yeah,
because it had Mary Tyler Moore and Richard Chamberlain. Then, at the height of their television fame, she had just come off the Dick Van Dyke Show. He had just come off Dr. Kildare. They were going to be in a musical based on Truman Capote's famous novel, the Audrey Hepburn movie. I mean, people wanted to see this show, and it was so bad. David Merrick said, nope, I'm not even. He said, I will not subject people to this. It is so bad. So it'll be fun to report on that. It'll be fun to dig up something.
I think that's a great book.
Thanks.
That's a great book. I mean, and great stories. As long as you can,
I can always count on the people who want to read these kinds of books will buy these kinds of books.
Of course, they will.
I've got that set amount of people who want it in their library, want it on their shelf. A Kindle will not do. And to them, those are the people I'm writing my books for. I'm not doing these to get rich. I'm doing them to share stories. I love the theater and I love theater stories. And that's why I'm here. I feel like after all these years, you started this asking me about my career as an actor. I feel this is what I was put on the earth for, Donald, to tell these stories in this kind of a form and to write my columns.
And so you
thank you for this, for expression of my being able to tell people that and talk about the book.
And you love research because it's not writing.
Exactly, in the famous words of Winnie Olson. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Ron, I'm so glad that you were able to come on the show and chat about the book. And hopefully you will be back to chat about the next one.
Anytime. If you want to talk about the upcoming Broadway season as it comes to a close, I will have seen every single show and we can discuss what's going to be up with the Tony and all that kind of stuff.
I am on my way to New York. I just booked my trip, but we can talk about that off mic. So I will be in New York very soon. So we can chat off mic about some of that momentarily. But
You sorry you're going to miss all that, everybody out there?
Yeah. Anyway, thanks again, Ron. It was a fantastic talking to you.
Thank you.
And much success with the book. Everybody get out there and purchase, please. The show goes on and get it from Ron directly. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye, Donald.